couple weeks ago, we interviewed tech blogger Dean Takahashi about the wildly popular Facebook game Farmville, but the vast landscape of some 63 million players tending to their virtual fields may not be as bucolic as it seems. Farmville and other apps like those catchy quizzes on Facebook often leave the barn door wide open to spammers. Dennis Yu ought to know. He used to be one of those spammers. He's the CEO of the ad agency Blitz Local. Recently wrote a guest posting on TechCrunch called How to Spam Facebook Like a Pro, an Insider's Confession. Mr. Yu joins us now from Dallas. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
So what happens when you, and we'll use Farmville as an example, but how does that throw open the door?
When the Facebook platform opened in June of 07, it allowed developers to build applications that sit on top of the Facebook platform to use user data. When a user clicks accept that they want to join, most of their profile information is now available. That can be used to create a very intense, addictive game, but it can also be used for advertising. And when you can use that data inside an ad to inject a user's name, their profile picture, the information of their friends, it creates highly relevant, highly targeted advertising, very smart ads. We can call them app-fertizing, for example. And maybe they know your birthday, and they can say, hey, Scott, happy birthday. We'd like to show you, here's a free slice of cake. You can do very relevant social advertising when you know about who they are. The trouble becomes when advertisers who are bad players in the market, now that this new information is available, will use it in deceptive ways. And Facebook has, on a number of occasions, cracked down on these bad players to be able to say, you cannot inject user information into the ads. So that's not being done anymore. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to try to stay one step ahead. It's a game of whack-a-mole where you close down these holes and other people find a way to go around it, and there are loopholes here, and you're constantly trying to enforce it, and that's what happens whenever you open a new platform.
Mr. Yu, why are you coming clean on this? Why are you feeling remorseful?
When you do things that are deceptive, you can make a quick buck, but that never lasts. Mm-hmm. So independent of any sort of ethical concerns, for the long term, actually doing things that are trustworthy, where we're working closely with Facebook themselves, is a smart business play.
Anything people can do to kind of play defense?
Obviously, caveat emptor. Don't put your cell phone number when they ask for it. Be very careful if you are agreeing to put in your email address, right? Because it's not Facebook necessarily that's asking you for an email address. And make sure that that fan page that is asking you to friend it actually is that fan page. The same things that you see traditionally on the internet where they say, hey, your winner number 99999, or your computer may be infected. Of course, anything that claims to be too good to be true, you should worry about that. Or maybe you see a message from a friend, because they're guys who have created spyware that will come in and take over your computer, send messages to all your friends. A couple weeks ago, somebody sent me a message. It was another industry colleague in the local search space. And he said, I'm stuck in London. Can you wire me some money? My wallet got stolen from me. And I thought, well, I barely know this guy, but man, he's an important person. Maybe I can do something to help. And later, when I contacted this fellow, he said, oh, no, I didn't contact you. And I realized what had actually happened. So identity theft is happening in the most interesting sort of ways. So you've got to be careful.
In the meantime, your blog, DennisYu.com, you say that you're still playing Farmville. How's your wheat field doing?
I think I actually have some crops that have rotted on me. Playing Farmville is actually a lot of fun. I talked to their head of business development a week ago, and he said that over half the revenue comes from people who actually outright buy the currency. It's amazing, though, because you have to tip your hat. I don't think that the game developers are necessarily bad. They're just trying – they're going to do whatever to make money, and they're trusting the ad networks. They're not experts in the advertising business. They're experts at making games.
Dennis Yu, CEO of Blitz Local, speaking with us from Dallas. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Did Black Friday, as it's called, live up to its billing and actually put retailers in the black? We've invited Nigel Gault, Chief U.S. Economist for IHS Global Insight, to join us, talk about today's retail news. Mr. Gault, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks very much.
It's a little early to be definitive, I understand, but what's your understanding of how sales went yesterday?
It seems like the shoppers were out in force, perhaps more than last year. In terms of the spending, looks like spending may have been rather similar to a year ago, perhaps a little higher. I think the message is the shoppers were out, but they were being very careful with their spending. When they saw a bargain, they were prepared to act, but they were keeping quite a tight rein.
But isn't the whole idea of selling something on discount, or at least it used to be, you sell something on sale because you hope when somebody's in the tent, they'll buy something at retail price?
That's the idea. But I think shoppers know that their financial situation is a lot worse than it would have been a year ago. They're worried about the outlook for the economy, about unemployment. So I think they're targeting things much more than in the past. They're looking for that bargain. If a bargain's there, they're taking it, but they're being much more careful about those discretionary impulse purchases than in the past.
And surely it must cost retailers more money to open up their stores at 2 a.m. And as you know, I'm not being hyperbolic when I say 2 a.m. Some retailers did that.
Indeed. Retailers seem to be opening earlier every year. Competition is very tough out there. And, of course, each retailer is seeking to essentially get the jump on the other retailers. They know that the consumer is being very careful. They know they're going to have to work very hard to get that consumer dollar. So even if the consumer overall isn't spending that much differently from last year, there's a lot of pressure on retailers to make sure that each one of them tries to get that dollar.
The Monday after Thanksgiving is now known, at least this year, as Cyber Monday. Because presumably a lot of people who've returned to work on Monday start shopping on their computers during work hours, I might add.
That's right.
What do you foresee for that?
That might be shaping up to be quite good this year because it does appear, at least in the past few days, that there's been more of a tendency for people to do their shopping online, people who are fed up with going out and having to battle with the crowds in the actual stores are now looking for the bargains online. So it doesn't mean it's going to be any easier for the retailers to get the consumer's dollar. They still have to discount and give them a reason to buy. But we may see more online shopping this year than in previous years.
Mr. Gault, help us understand what a seasonal jolt, if that's even what we confront this year, can do for the economy overall. I mean, is it a one-trick pony and the effect is gone by January, February?
In a sense, yes. I mean, it probably isn't going to make all the difference between a strong recovery for the economy and an economy that falls back into recession. But I think we can take this season as an indication of the consumer mood. Are people feeling more confident about the future? Is the consumer going to participate in this recovery? I don't think anybody thinks the consumer is going to lead, but we do need the consumer to participate. So in that sense, it is going to be give us a signal of where we might be going for the broader economy next year.
Nigel Gault, Chief U.S. Economist for IHS Global Insight, thanks for being with us and happy holidays.
Thank you very much.
This is the weekend of the turkey sandwich. And with that masterpiece of leftovers comes a crucial decision. Do you cut the bread straight across into rectangles or corner to corner into triangles? Okay, so maybe you haven't given this choice a moment's thought, but our producer, Alice Winkler, has a lot of thought.
I am not alone. I always thought the diagonal cut just made the sandwich better. And then I started to ask around, and it turns out most everyone I asked agreed, even my kids.
Diagonal.
Really? How come?
Because it tastes better that way. Because it gets less crust because you're cutting it that way in half.
But okay, they are my kids, and it could be genetic. Kemp Minifee, however, was the executive food editor for Gourmet magazine until its recent demise, and she agrees diagonal rules.
Well, right angles can be boring. You think of rooms. We like curved windows, bay windows. And I think in our lives there's always there's that little bit of out of the box. I'm not going to be boxed in.
Words to live by, for sure. Minifee says the diagonal cut creates the illusion that your sandwich is bigger. If you like to start with a corner bite, it's easier to fit that sharp angle into your mouth without a mess. And if you like to avoid crust, you have a nice, wide, soft surface to attack. Her passion was born early.
My mother used to cut her sandwiches in half crosswise, and I never liked that. I always liked the diagonal, and the diagonal is what you got in the deli, in the coffee shop or diner. And I used to love to watch them make it. Let's say the grilled cheese, so they have it on the griddle, and then they'd slide it off, and with that one swift stroke, cut it in half diagonally.
I wanted to witness the magic, so I headed out to the Tasty Diner. That's Tasty with a double E at the end, and a mountain of home fries biding their time on the grill. And just like out of Kemp Minifee's dream, I found Spanky.
It's squared off. It doesn't even look like a sandwich, you know.
Nathan Spanky Lewis is an institution at this griddle in Bethesda, Maryland, and you will never catch him cutting a sandwich straight from side to side. Why? He sums it up in a word.
It's just reputation, you know, 30 years of cooking.
Reputation? I left the Tasty Diner full, but not quite satisfied. Then it hit me. Who knows more about angles and aesthetics than an architect? Meet Kevin Harris, who designs homes in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. His favorite sandwich, by the way, is a Reuben. And if he were making one at home?
I would cut it on the diagonal, absolutely.
Kevin Harris says that since the time of the pyramids, architects have understood the supremacy of the diagonal line.
By cutting it on the diagonal, you have the hypotenuse of the rectangle, which is, of course, the longest section. And it exposes more of the interior of the sandwich. And by exposing the interior, it engages more of your senses before you take the first bite. It's less of a surprise, and it's more revealing, almost like a burlesque dancer. It's covered enough to be clothed, but uncovered enough to be very, very appealing.
So it comes down to sex and to math, really. The amount of crust on a sandwich does not change, no matter how you cut it. But the amount of surface area without crust can change. If you start with a 4-inch square sandwich, for example, you end up with 3 inches more crust-free surface just by cutting corner to corner. I called Paul Coulter, an emeritus professor of mathematics, to check my numbers. I was right, but he was ready to talk about deeper things, the mystical force of three, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and Plato's book, The Timaeus.
He describes the creation of the universe, and he wants to describe it in terms of small elements. Now, they thought that there were four elements, earth, air, fire, and water, and he ascribed a solid to each of these, the so-called Platonic solids, and earth was represented by the cube. And the cube has square faces, and he wanted to subdivide the faces down further. So what he did, he didn't cut the square face in half parallel to the sides. He cut it corner to corner. So this triangle, which is technically the isosceles right triangle, according to Plato, was one of the basic building blocks of the universe.
Whoa, the universe, the sandwich, the diagonal, it's all coming together. All right, this is where I admit that maybe the search for an answer to an insignificant question has gone a little too far. So I leave you to your turkey sandwich and your knife. The choice is yours and yours alone.
That's our producer, Alice Winkler. You can weigh in on the triangle versus rectangle debate. Comment on our website, npr.org.
Time for sports. Plentiful food and great football. That's Thanksgiving, right? But was the real turkey this year served at the table or on the field? I tell you, if the NFL relied on Thanksgiving games to fuel fan interest, curling might be more popular. Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, join us. Morning, Howard. How are you?
Good morning, Scott. Happy Thanksgiving.
And also to you, my friend. If I weren't a Chicago Bears fan, I'd call the Detroit Lions the most hapless team in football.
It's awful. It was just awful. Could we please cease and desist with the Detroit Lions on Thanksgiving Day? It's a tradition that needs to go. It was actually a really fascinating day in terms of just how bad the games were. You couldn't have asked for a worse three games. Even the final game, which had two potential playoff teams, the Broncos and the Giants, that was a terrible game. It was just the scheduling gods just really weren't very kind this year. The only thing worse would have been to have the New Jersey Nets play a basketball game that night. They're 0-16. It was bad. I was glad it was over. And I don't usually say that too often.
Well, let me ask you questions about these two one-storied franchises. Detroit Lions lost every game last year. That hadn't been done before. They haven't won any kind of championship in 50 years, I believe as long as it's been owned by William Clay Ford Sr.
Yes.
Are people saying it's time to move this team to Toronto and new ownership?
Well, the Toronto question is an outstanding one. And you're starting to hear it more and more. The NFL hasn't had a major franchise shift in the last 10 or 12 years since you had Los Angeles and Houston lose their franchises back in the mid-90s. And now there's been talk about Los Angeles getting a franchise and, of course, Toronto getting a franchise.
Yeah.
And the Buffalo Bills had for long been the front runners to move to Toronto. And now it's not surprising that people are talking about the Lions as well. But that's not really what bothers me about the Detroit Lions. The NFL has a salary cap. They have mechanisms in place where a trained monkey could make the playoffs inside of 5 years. Every team has a chance to win, and this is just a horribly run franchise. It's just not a very good situation out there because they don't evaluate. They get the first pick every year, and they just cannot win. They're a bad organization.
And Al Davis doesn't seem to be doing his storied Oakland Raiders much good at the moment.
Well,
they
haven't been storied for some time. They've been in one Super Bowl in the last 27 years, and they were destroyed in it by the Buccaneers, by a coach Al Davis fired, John Gruden, in Tampa Bay. They've been more well-known for, once again, for their franchise front office trouble. They're just, another bad franchise. I think one interesting thing about professional sports is that we spend a lot of time attacking the players, and this guy's a bum, and that guy's a bum, and this guy should be traded. Yeah, but I think a lot of the bums are in management, and they get a free pass all the time.
And in the minute we have left, perhaps the ranking athlete in the world, Tiger Woods, is apparently fine. It was an accident early yesterday in his car in front of his house. Out of the hospital now, apparently, and is apparently just fine. Leaving his home at 2:30 in the morning, was he going to one of those overnight sales at Walmart?
It was Black Friday for Tiger. I don't understand that story. I tried reading it again and again. It made no sense. At first, you had the police who were saying that it was a serious issue, that he was in serious condition.
Yeah.
And then you read the story saying that, from him saying he was fine. Then you read a story saying that his wife took a golf club to the car to get him out of the car.
Yeah,
so
sure.
It struck me that someone's got to get their story straight about what had happened with Mr. Woods after Thanksgiving.
Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN.com, ESPN the magazine, and ESPN the leftover stuffing. Thanks. I'm the leftover stuffing. Thanks very much, my friend. Take care.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.